From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Barack Obama and race in America. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point. As President Obama prepares tonight's farewell speech, his approval ratings are well above many ex-presidents and much higher than Donald Trump's. He's bound to go down in history as the first black president of a nation with a legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, and other forms of racial discrimination. Today, we'll ask activists and historians about the example he and his family have set during the past 8 years. Are millions of black people better off because of his policies? On this last of our series about the Obama presidency, what's the state of race relations after his 2 terms in the White House? Today's talking point, repeal of Obamacare. Easier said than done, despite the promises of Donald Trump and other Republicans. First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. The election and re-election of the first black president led to predictions of a post-racial America. Today, we'll talk about Barack Obama's 8 years in the White House and what they mean for race relations in the future. Later on today's talking point, repeal of Obamacare was the GOP's first order of business, but it's facing 20 million roadblocks, the people who have health insurance that didn't have it before. Some Republican senators are expressing new misgivings about moving too fast. First, this news update. Alabama's Republican Senator Jeff Sessions was grilled this morning by Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's Donald Trump's nominee to be Attorney General of the United States. Here's California Democrat Dianne Feinstein.
You have referred to Roe v. Wade as, quote, one of the worst, colossally erroneous Supreme Court decisions of all time, end quote. Is that still your view?
It is. I believe it violated the Constitution and really attempted to set policy and not follow law. It is the law of the land. It has been so established and settled for quite a long time, and it deserves respect, and I would respect it and follow it.
Jeff Bennett is senior Washington reporter for New York One. Great to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
How did the Democrats respond to that?
Well, the Democrats have responded to that by saying that Senator Sessions still has not met the burden of proof to prove himself worthy of being effectively the nation's top lawyer. And you heard Senator Feinstein there bring up that issue and others to undercut the argument that all of Senator Sessions' controversies are well in the past. And he did say that on issues of settled law, whether that it's abortion rights or same-sex marriage, that those issues have been settled and that he would support them as attorney general. But, you know, that he still has a ways to go, frankly. And the confirmation hearing has really been punctuated not only by protesters, but warnings from Democrats that, you know, minorities fear he wouldn't protect their rights as the leader of the Justice Department. And he went to great lengths to directly deny the accusations of racial insensitivity that sunk his 1986 nomination to be a federal judge, because back then an African-American former assistant U.S. attorney told the committee that Sessions had called him, quote, a boy, and told him, you know, be careful what you say around white folks. Another witness 30 years ago testified that he called the NAACP and the ACLU un-American, and he said that they were communist-inspired. So he fought back against all of that today, but this is the first of 2 days of hearings that have already been relatively contentious.
It was Ronald Reagan, of course, who nominated him for a judgeship in 1986. Here today is Sessions defending his record then and now.
This caricature of me in 1986 was not correct. I am the same person, perhaps wiser and maybe a little better, I hope so, today than I was then, but I did not harbor the kind of animosities and race-based discrimination ideas that were I was accused of. I did not.
Jeff Bennett, is there any likelihood that there might be enough Republicans against Sessions to prevent his nomination from going to the floor of the Senate?
No, Sessions appears to have enough support from Senate Republicans to win confirmation. Senator Jeff Flake, the Republican in Arizona, he's a potential swing vote on that committee. He will support Sessions, and that's a key pickup considering that Flake has very different views on immigration and some other social issues. So if Sessions clears the committee, and it appears that he will, he'll likely win a floor vote and essentially become the nation's top law enforcement officer. But I spoke with Sherrilyn Ifill today. She's the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And this gets to the issue that Sessions was trying to speak to in that soundbite we heard. She brought up another issue and said that, you know, even if you discount what happened 30 years ago, what's in his record of 40 years of service still suggests that he can't be trusted to be the attorney general. And she brought up this his failed prosecution of a 1985 voter fraud case in Alabama involving three black activists. Now, those three were quickly acquitted, but that case really has shadowed the senator with questions about whether he sought to intimidate black voters. Now, the son of one of those activists issued a surprise endorsement of Sessions last week, but the mother of another one of the activists said that it's still a painful chapter in the family's history and that she would not support Sessions' nomination. So even though it does appear that he does have enough support to be confirmed, these issues will no doubt dog him because he really is the exact opposite of the attorney general we have now in so many ways, in so many of the issues that he supports. And so this is something that Democrats say they're going to take very seriously. And frankly, he's one of the eight Trump cabinet nominees that Democrats said they were planning to target and try and attempt to draw out so that President-elect Trump wouldn't have a full cabinet when he takes office in the next week.
15 seconds left. You know what that means. Was he questioned about waterboarding?
He says that he does not support waterboarding, that he's in line with the Obama administration's position on torture. He also said that he has no reason to doubt the intelligence community's report on the Russian hacking. He effectively disagreed with Donald Trump's position on Muslim immigration, that he would only support limiting immigration from people who come from countries that have histories of terrorism. So there's enough there to draw some daylight between he and the president-elect, but still not enough for Democrats to get on board.
Okay. And once again, he will be Attorney General of the United States, not just a member of the president's cabinet. Jeff Bennett, again, reporter for New York One. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, Barack Obama and Race in America on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. This is the last of our special series on the Obama presidency. After two terms in the White House, he'll deliver his farewell address tonight in Chicago. He is, of course, the first black president of a nation with a legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, and other forms of racial discrimination. Today, we'll talk with a panel of activists and thinkers about the past 8 years and what they mean for the future. We'll start with Peniel Joseph. He is director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas, Austin. Professor, good to have you back on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good to be here.
In a piece that you wrote about the president, you draw special attention to a very touching anecdote about a little boy who asked the president if he could feel his hair. Why did you point to that?
Yeah, that happened in 2012, Warren, and I think that's an example of the impact of President Obama on the psyche of not just African-Americans, but really all Americans. The fact that you had this little boy whose father actually had worked for the White House, and they were exiting and taking pictures like families who work for the White House often do. And their five-year-old son asked if he could feel the president's hair, if his hair was just like his. And Obama said yes. And the White House photographer caught a picture of that, and it went viral on social media. But it's very, very important to remember that part of what we're doing when we try to distill his legacy and the nuances of the legacy beyond policy, which is going to be very, very important, beyond what he did foreign, domestically. It's really, what did he represent for tens of millions of people and for many people, especially within the African-American community? Both Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, their daughters Malia and Sasha, really represented this validation of black excellence, something that within the black community was always known and acknowledged, but was rarely acknowledged in American society outside of popular culture. So you think about the Cosby Show, and you think about Oprah Winfrey or Michael Jordan. The Obamas really changed the landscape and the aesthetics for both black and white people. And remember, there's millions and millions of young kids who came of age during 8 years where they saw a black president and first lady, and they thought that was fine, and they just thought that's the way things are. And for those of us who are older, we know that this was an extraordinary thing that became normalized. So I wanted to really play that up.
Of course, that's important, and you describe it eloquently. But what about his record in terms of policy? And has it, in fact, improved the quality of life for black Americans?
Well, that's going to be much more mixed. When we think about policy, first, the good. The good is that in terms of saving the economy in 2009, the good is going to be everything from when we think about criminal justice reform, not enough criminal justice reform, but certainly he's the one who put in Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch as Attorney General. And now that we're getting Jeff Sessions, we see how progressive that was in that case. So there's going to be different things that they tried to do. They settled some longstanding lawsuits with black farmers who for years had not been given fair access to the Agricultural Adjustment Act. So in a lot of ways, the biggest thing he did for black people was through cabinet posts and through different bureaus of the federal government, and certainly the Affordable Care Act. When we think about policy, the Affordable Care Act disproportionately impacted poor black and Latinos who never had access to affordable insurance. So the biggest policy benefit that black people received during his 8 years was that. Now, the negative is many. Historically, black people and their unemployment rates and their rates of segregation, when we think about schools, when we think about employment, when we think about access to fresh food and clean water, when we think about the environment and environmental racism and toxins, and we think about Flint, Michigan, they've always been disproportionately overrepresented in negative social economic indicators. And when we think about the Obama administration, there wasn't the kind of policies that would have really changed that. Beyond the Affordable Care Act, Obama's perspective was a rising tide lifts all boats, and you would need some kind of targeted policies. We no longer support as a nation affirmative action, but there's no way to end black inequality in this country, or anybody's inequality. When we think about women and equal pay with the Ledbetter Act, or LGBTQ issues and marriage equality, they've got to be targeted, and we live in an era where people didn't want to have any targeted programs. And the president sort of spoke out of both sides of his mouth here. On one level, he didn't favor targeted programs. On another, by the second administration, he starts his My Brother's Keeper program, which is really private money, $200 million, and that is a targeted program for young black boys at risk. And Michelle Obama also has a targeted program for young black women. But those are drop in the buckets compared to the glaring need within the black community.
Peniel Joseph, once again, at the University of Texas, Austin. Now, here's Mr. Obama's own assessment of race relations. He delivered this speech in last year, at Howard University.
Race relations are better since I graduated. That's the truth. No, my election did not create a post-racial society. I don't know who was propagating that notion. That was not mine. But the election itself, and the subsequent one, because the first one, folks might have made a mistake. The second one, they knew what they were getting. The election itself was just one indicator of how attitudes have changed.
DeRay McKesson is a leader of the social justice movement Black Lives Matter. He's also a former candidate for mayor of Baltimore. Mr. McKesson, good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Do you agree with Peniel Joseph that the record is mixed as far as the lives of African-American people are concerned?
Yeah, I think it's mixed, but I will say, just like Peniel said, is that Obamacare hugely important in communities across the country, especially in communities of color. And when we think about criminal justice reform, is that Obama did create a foundation for substantive change. I think that that change would have been potentially more impactful if there was a Clinton presidency following up. But when we think about the issue of policing, the task force on 21st century policing, powerful recommendations came out of it. I think about the space that he made to listen and hear from activists. But I do think it came a little too late, right? It came at the end of the administration. We saw the DOJ be more aggressive in the Civil Rights Division than it's ever been. We think about the consent decrees. But we know that there's way more work to be done. So we think about the federal, the threshold to charge people like Darren Wilson didn't get charged and so many other police officers have. And I think that that work was actually beginning to move in this administration. And it would have been powerful to see it carried on in Clinton's. I think that we are all nervous about what comes next when the Trump people seem really focused on undoing the wins that we got during the Obama years.
I should say, I think, and it's important, that the Affordable Care Act affected a lot of white poor people as well as African-Americans and Latinos. But do you think that he was less aggressive in this regard in his first term because he was concerned about being reelected?
I don't know if he was necessarily concerned about being reelected as much as I think that he was worried about getting one big win and he got it. And then, you know, Rahm left. And, you know, I think many people would say that he did not use the power that he had at the beginning in a way that he could. But I'm also mindful that this was his first time really as an executive. So I think that they were all learning, too, which is no excuse for him. I do think that explains some of the slowness at the beginning.
So you think then that overall, the situation for African-Americans is better than it used to be, even though you've had to become a member and a leader of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, so this is what I said to President Obama both times we met with him, right? It is better than it used to be, but that doesn't mean that there's not significant work to be done. So, yeah, so I got tear gas in cities all across the country. I got tear gas in Ferguson, and I, like many other people, have been in the streets fighting back against a government that is literally killing people in cities across the country. With that said, I know that change happens slowly and that systems break in pieces. And part of this work is about how do we identify the right pieces to press to be the right levers in this work. And I think the administration was actually listening. I think he was listening and focused on these issues. I do think that there's significant work to be done, and I'm worried about what comes next in a Trump presidency.
DeRay McKesson, once again, with Black Lives Matter. There were moments, of course, when Mr. Obama spoke loud and clear about his own racial background, and here's his reaction to the shooting death of the unarmed black boy, Trayvon Martin. That happened in Florida.
You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. And you know, I think they are right to expect that all of us, as Americans, are going to take this with the seriousness it deserves and that we're going to get to the bottom of exactly what happened.
Jason Johnson is politics editor of The Root. He's also professor of political science at Morgan State University. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
A lot of people said when the president made those made that statement, that it was kind of risky. Do you agree?
No, it's only risky to bigots. I mean, look, the fact of the matter is Barack Obama is a black man. He has a black wife. If he had a son, he would have a black son. And that black son would be disproportionately likely to be a victim of both vigilante violence and police violence in the United States. There was always this notion throughout the entire Obama administration that if he dared say anything that is just a basic reality to black lives, that he would risk offending white people. And I always thought that that was sort of a strange caution because his very existence offended lots of white Americans, and there was nothing he was going to be able to do to change that. He should have spent more time speaking the truth instead of trying to cater to people who were never going to like him.
Would he have won re-election if he had done that?
I think against Mitt Romney, yes. I mean, you know, there's a difference between offending people and telling a truth that people find offensive. You know, when the president came out and said, look, you know, my son would look like Trayvon, people are mad at that because they're bigots. That's pretty much all there is to it. You could have some people who complain that the president shouldn't put their fingers into what is a local police case, but that's not really what it was about. Barack Obama got reelected in 2012 because the economy was improving, because he had higher personal approval ratings, and because Mitt Romney was the wrong kind of rich person and seemed even more detached from regular Americans than Republicans tried to make Obama look like. So I think he would have gotten reelected even if he had been more forceful.
Do you think in any sense he was too perfect?
No. There is no perfection on this earth. And President Barack Obama didn't come close. I think that what he was is sort of optimistic and naive and sort of arrogant and cowardly at the same time, if those are the words that really come to mind. President Barack Obama sincerely believed in people's better angels. He sincerely believed that if he made a strong enough and a persuasive enough case, that people would overlook their personal animosity and personal bigotries and personal experiences and pass laws or engage in behavior that would be to the benefit of all Americans. And he was wrong. He was wrong throughout his entire administration. He was wrong in this 2016 election. And we are all going to suffer from the consequences of his belief that if people really saw what was going to be best for all, they would choose that over their own selfish ends.
Let me go back to Peniel Joseph, our professor at the University of Texas, Austin. Do you think that the president could have done more? And is there any sense in which you're disappointed in his performance?
Yeah, I think he could have done a lot more. I think in terms of racial leadership and racial justice leadership and also economic justice, he was too often reactionary. And he was reactionary in two senses of the word. On one level, he was constantly responding to crisis. So when you think about Trayvon Martin or the Charleston shooting or Ferguson, he was constantly sort of flat-footed. And sometimes he responded very well, like he did in the Amazing Grace speech. Sometimes it was much more flat-footed, like he did after the uprising in Ferguson a few days after Thanksgiving in 2014. And he was also reactionary when you think about it in a political sense. When he went to Howard University, Morehouse, and different places, and he was scolding African-American college graduates to work hard and not complain about racism. And he never did such a thing to white women at Barnard College or any other set of white audiences. He only did it to black people in the NAACP, and that's racist. That's racist and condescending. So those are.
Let me get a response to that from DeRay McKesson. Go ahead. Was he racist?
I mean, I don't know. You know, racism is about power. I don't think that that was necessarily racism, but I do think that the larger point around the way he used the bully pulpit in ways that were disproportionately sort of scolding sometimes, I think, was frustrating. And I will say that in the criminal justice space, again, I think at the end of the administration was much more aggressive. But, you know, our push to him every time we talked to him was like, you could today change the way the federal government funded police departments. Like, you could today make the DOJ condition funding on collecting data or on a host of other practices, like use of force policies and stuff like that. And he was not willing to do that. And like that's hard, right? I think he listened, I think he heard, but he could have done more.
Jason Johnson, just a couple of seconds left before we go to a break. But how about his response to the whole birther movement, which, of course, was carried on by the current president-elect?
I thought it was great. I mean, he responded with both humor and tact and a sort of detached sense of, I cannot believe I even have to answer this. I think that was probably one of the better things about President Obama, that he had the ability to respond to some criticism with a cool detachment, not that dissimilar from, you know, a great stand-up comedian. I mean, I thought that was one of the better things he did. Unfortunately, you know, that rumor persisted throughout his presidency.
All right. We're going to take a very brief break, as I suggested on our talking point letter. We'll talk about repeal of Obamacare. We've already heard it mentioned as well. It's easier said than done, though, despite the promises of Republicans. We'll also continue this conversation, of course, before we get there. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're not only back with To The Point. This is the last of our series on the Obama presidency, and we're talking today about his impact on race in America. Andra Gillespie is a political scientist at Emory University. She's author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. Welcome to our program, Professor.
Thank you.
You really want to use the term post-racial America? We heard the president saying we're not there yet.
Well, my editors make me use the term post-racial.
And the reason why
they asked me to use that is because I write about deracialized campaign strategies. Somebody like President Obama is the type of politician who wants to try to create a broad multiracial coalition. And so for that reason, he's more likely to try to de-emphasize race as opposed to running on a civil rights platform or running as an explicitly black candidate. Had President Obama done that, he wouldn't have gotten the nomination, and he certainly wouldn't have won the presidency, even if he had won the nomination. And the problem with deracialization is that while it's effective, while it tends to make non-black voters more comfortable with an African-American candidate, it does raise issues about how they're able to govern, particularly with respect to addressing issues that specifically target minority communities, and also what happens when you have to react and respond to other types of issues. So some of the reactions that the other panelists have spoken about is really a reflection of the fact that President Obama, when he ran as a candidate, really didn't want to try to emphasize his race because that had the ability to potentially be a liability for him. Unfortunately, in America, we're not post-racial. He knew that in 2008. Everybody on this panel knew that in 2008, but he still had to run with the media perception that America was post-racial, and that constrained his ability to be able to be nimble in responding to some of the racial issues that have been mentioned before.
Teray McKesson, back to you with Black Lives Matter. Do you agree with that, and does that cause you to essentially forgive him for not being sufficiently focused and publicly focused on African Americans? Ray McKesson, you still with us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No.
Yeah.
So I think that's a fair assessment. I'm not sure that this is about forgiveness as much as it is acknowledging that he was trying to win an election and that he made certain calculations that have an impact on the way that he was governing. Again, I think that at the end of the administration is when he finally caught his mojo, but it was too late in so many ways to do the kind of change that he wanted to do. I do think history will be kinder to him, and I think that he might have more of an impact on issues related to black people specifically in post-presidency than he did as president, which is not necessarily comforting, but I'm hopeful about that. And I think that he's created a lot of infrastructure for change to happen, but we all acknowledge that it didn't move at the pace that we thought it would move when he was in the White House.
Let me just point out, forgiveness was my term. I don't think anybody on this program has accused Barack Obama of anything except doing the best that he could. Professor Gillespie, back to you. What about the fact that for so many years of his terms, he had a Republican Congress to deal with, and did that make it more difficult for him in the context that we're discussing?
That's going to provide an institutional constraint on his ability to be able to act. So unless he can forge a bipartisan coalition, which is incredibly difficult to do in this era where we are increasingly polarized along partisan lines, and where our polarization has reached a fever pitch that we arguably haven't seen probably since around the time of the Civil War, that's going to make it incredibly difficult for him to act. I also think probably one of the big things that we've learned as a result of the Obama presidency is we might have a greater kind of street understanding of how federalism works with respect to racial issues. Historically, African Americans have looked to the federal government, particularly courts, in order to receive civil rights redress because we've had hostile local and state governments that were oftentimes perpetrating Jim Crow. And that's sort of led to us always focusing on the national government. Well, we finally got a black executive, and we learned what presidents can do and what presidents can't do. So I think as a result of the Obama presidency, there is a greater recognition of the importance of understanding which level of government and which branch of government actually are the ones who are responsible directly for the issues that affect our lives. And so there are ways that the executive branch can help oversee police departments, for instance, but if you really want to affect the police department, then you have to be involved in local politics to be able to do that.
Local politics and presumably state politics as well.
Yeah.
Peniel Joseph, back to you. A reference was made to the Civil War, and we hear it again and again that there's more race consciousness now, perhaps, than at any time since then. I don't know if that's true or not, but some have drawn the conclusion that the United States, particularly given the kind of racism that we heard in the presidential campaign, wasn't ready for a black president.
Well, no, I wouldn't. I think the country was absolutely ready for it. I think that one of the things that we don't understand with our history, Warren, is that we have these two competing, broadly speaking, notions of American democracy. One is a segregationist notion that goes back to, you know, Senator Calhoun from South Carolina and Vice President Calhoun and others, and the Redeemer South that rose up after Reconstruction that not only organized the Klan and state-sanctioned violence against black people, but it also organized black codes and public policy, including public policy that disfranchised people, specifically black men, who had felony convictions as part of convict lease systems. So when we think about today, for instance, Jeff Sessions and Barack Obama, it's a stark juxtaposition that the first black president is exiting the stage while you have somebody who is seen as a racially intolerant supportive of the Klan is being nominated to be attorney general. So it's a kind of, for some people, this historical mashup in one era. But it actually is not as stark as people think. There's always been these two competing visions. In the post 1950s and 60s era, the person who best articulates the vision for racial equality is Martin Luther King Jr., but King faced massive resistance by people like Strom Thurmond, by people like Robert Byrd, who then became a proponent of racial justice, by people like George Wallace. So what's interesting with Sessions and Obama, and even the fact that Obama becomes president, the country has always been of at least two broadly speaking minds. And sometimes we think of it as a racial schizophrenia, but it's really business as usual, where you have Obama gets the two largest popular votes in American history as a black president, and at the same time, you've got Donald Trump is elected, and you've got the support of the alt-right and this sort of neo-Confederacy. So we've always been a country that, at the same time that you can have racial progress and people who feel racial justice and they want equality for all, that you have different bands of people who are organizing politically, whether they're saying it like they did in the 19th century or not, like they're doing now, they're organizing on behalf of a very specific vision of American democracy that's racially exclusive, that's segregated, that's largely male, that's largely intolerant, and that is really articulating a politics of white supremacy. You can have both those things in the same nation. And I think sometimes the world right now, today, is looking at us very, very surprised. How could you go from Obama to Trump? But any of us who are students of American history, we realize how all these things are always existing within the same context. So just because you have Obama get the largest vote total in 2008, it doesn't mean that Jeff Sessions or Mitch McConnell or people who felt that way somehow were no longer part of the nation. What they were doing was organizing within the confines of our democracy to say, how can we take power too? And this is going to continue. Post-Trump, we may see the most racially progressive president ever elected. It may be a woman. It may be a black woman. And people, their heads are going to spin and say, well, how can they go from Obama to Trump to this new person? It's all of a piece of our history.
Okay. I should point out to our and remind our listeners that before you guys came on, we did hear from Senator Sessions. He was denying the racism that is attributed to him and that goes all the way back to in 1986 when he was refused the judgeship. I don't want to – I'm not making a case for him, but just want to point out that that was an issue today in his confirmation hearing. Jason Johnson, back to you. We heard Professor Gillespie talk about how important things are at the state and local level. To what extent do you think the election that just ended was the result in part of voting rights acts by states and local governments?
Well, that was completely what it was. I mean, it was the first presidential election in over 50 years where we didn't have the Voting Rights Act. And you saw what happened in North Carolina, and you saw what happened in Wisconsin. You saw what happened in state after state after state, where you literally had a judge say that the Republican state house in North Carolina used laser-like precision to try and deny black people to vote. You got 300,000 people who were thrown off voting rolls in Wisconsin. Trump won the state by 28,000. And I think what was often missed by the press and what was not often discussed enough is, look, even if you throw 300,000 people off the rolls, even if a judge comes in later and says, all right, hey, that was wrong, you have to put them back, we don't know how quickly that happens. And if I'm a 43-year-old single mother who has an hourly job and I wanted to vote a week early and I show up and they say, hey, you're off the voting rolls, I may not have time to come back the next week. So this last election was in large part a result of structural issues. It wasn't a lack of turnout. It wasn't this, that, or the other. One other thing I want to mention very quickly, though, you talked about this idea of forgiveness. You know, I didn't have particularly high expectations of President Obama when he got elected. Either time, my attitude was just do less harm. One thing, though, I can say that I don't forgive him for, or one thing that I've always had an issue with, is President Obama's seeming refusal to use the power at his disposal to do things in the face of opposition that could not be convinced. DeRay mentioned earlier that, hey, look, the president could have said, we're going to take your funding if you don't collect data. That was easy. He could have done that. He didn't do it. The president could have, earlier this year, said, look, the House and Senate are on recess. I'm going to stick somebody on the Supreme Court, because having somebody on the Supreme Court is more important than this petty political argument. Over the recess this fall, after the election, there are over 100 judgeships that were denied during his eight-year presidency for no other reason other than obstruction and bigotry. He could have put all of those people in office rather than scrambling around and trying to make friends with Donald Trump. I wish Obama had used his power more rather than trying to negotiate with people. That is my greatest disappointment, and I'll never forgive him, if that's the word for that.
Professor Gillespie, what's your response to that? You're very interested in the structure of government and the uses of power, not just by the president, but at the local and state level as well.
I think those actions would have triggered so many lawsuits that I think it would have been problematic, and it would have created such a political distraction that it could have caused more problems. And so I understand the idealism behind that statement, but I understand President Obama's political calculation to not rock the boat on that.
How has he done in terms of appointments that he has, in fact, made?
Well, there have been a number of new symbolic appointments, for instance. So he definitely created, new councils to advise him on things. He definitely made strides in terms of the ceremonial symbolism of inviting more black artists to the White House. But President Obama largely continued in the tradition that had started during the Clinton administration of making sure that your appointments are increasingly more diverse. So if we look at President Obama's record compared to President Clinton and President Bush, George W. Bush, you see striking similarities across those three presidents. And that suggests that up until now, because we don't expect the Trump administration to be as diverse as the previous three administrations were, that there was some norm that there had to be some measure of descriptive representation in terms of the types of appointments that was made. And I think that stands out in part because so far, President-elect Trump's top-level appointees have been so not diverse that it's actually been taking notice. But, I mean, we would be remiss if we didn't notice that, at least as far as the cabinet-level appointments, George W. Bush in his first term had greater diversity than President Obama had.
I'm sorry, say that again?
If you look at the first-term appointees, so some of those initial appointees, particularly with respect to African-Americans, George W. Bush could compete in terms of the numbers of descriptively representative people he had in cabinet-level positions.
DeRoy McKesson with Black Lives Matter, are you surprised to hear that?
Yeah, I'd be interested to look at the data. I will say that I think that he appointed people not just at the highest levels, but throughout the federal government in ways that were deeply representative and demonstrable in terms of the impact. I think about sitting in so many meetings around policing, around criminal justice, where people at every level, like not only sort of conceptually understood the experiences, but lived the experiences in a way that seemed very different than the administrations before, whether that was the technology office or the cops office at the DOJ, or speaking with Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch themselves, or Valerie Jarrett. So I'd be interested to see the data, but I do think that they were deeply representative, not just at the highest levels, but throughout all levels of government.
Did Black Lives Matter come about, do you think, because of disappointment with President Obama, or was it encouraged by the fact that, as we heard at the beginning of our program, little boys saw a president with hair like theirs?
I think the movement began because, you know, Mike Brown got killed in Ferguson, and we knew that that was wrong, and we knew that we had to fight to get attention to the issue and fight for change. So I think that that's why the movement came along. I think that people, especially in the beginning, were more sympathetic to him because they thought that he shared the experience and understood the trauma of being a Black person in America. I think that the disillusionment came very quickly, though, when people did not see him move as quickly as we knew people's lives deserved. And I think that that is where some of the disappointment comes. I'm also mindful that Obama was a vessel for people's hope, and that that's always a failing enterprise, that you will never be able to live up to the immense amount of expectation that people have when you become the vessel for their hope. And you think about the 08 election, just how so many people were electrified by that. Just the iconography and the imagery and the symbolism of his election was something that I think made it an impossible perch to reach anyway. I do think that he got, like I said, more aggressive at the end. But that wasn't enough in many ways.
Peniel Joseph, just a few seconds left. What about his rhetoric?
Yeah, the rhetoric was soaring. And again, I do believe that for many Black people, they've always believed, including radicals, in American democracy and the expansive idea of American democracy. So in a lot of ways, his vision of a democratic society that was not only inclusive but could be led by a Black person and have a Black first lady was very, very dramatic and very, very, very important. Now, the devil is in the details, and there's going to be disappointment in how that was translated. But the rhetoric is still very, very powerful. And in a way, he's building on both the rhetoric of the Martin Luther King Jr.'s and the Jesse Jacksons, but also on the Barbara Jordans and others who came before him who tried to do this kind of fusion and and connect the Black experience to this wider American experience and show that Blackness could be universal.
Last June in South Carolina, after his eulogy for the racially motivated killings of 9 Black parishioners at Charleston's AME Church, Mr. Obama touched the hearts of the nation.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
Thanks so much to all of you. Peniel Joseph at the University of Texas Austin, DeRay McKesson with Black Lives Matter, former candidate for mayor of Baltimore, Jason Johnson at Morgan State University, Andre Gillespie at Emory University. In a moment, we'll be talking about Obamacare and the effort to repeal it. Not so easy as it sounds. Back in a moment. Warren Olney here with today's talking point. During last year's campaign, Donald Trump said that Obamacare could be replaced with something better. Leaders of the House and the Senate have been promising to repeal it for years, but there are at least 20 million problems, including the people with health insurance who didn't have it before. Now some Republican senators are expressing misgivings about immediate repeal. Jonathan Cohn is senior national correspondent for The Huffington Post. Good to have you back on our program.
Oh, good to be on the show.
How many Republican senators have indicated that, wait a minute, maybe we better slow this thing down a bit?
Well, you know, as it's changing pretty quickly, you could make a credible case as of this moment that we're up to 10, actually, if you really want to go through the list. I mean, everyone is saying different things, but we have, you know, several Republican senators who have said publicly in interviews on television, they all want to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Well, there's one now sort of who's even hedging on that a little bit. They all want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but they're saying, well, you know, wait a minute, let's slow this down. Let's make sure we know what we're doing. Let's make sure we know what's going to happen to those 20 million people who have coverage both immediately, you know, and then what kind of new, you know, right after we repeal the law, and then over the long term, what kind of system we're going to put in its place. So you have a bunch of them who have said it publicly on during interviews. Last night, you had 5 of them introduced an amendment to a budget resolution, and you know, like a lot of these things they do in Congress, it didn't have a lot of legal meaning, but symbolically it was sort of them throwing down a gauntlet saying, hey, we want to slow this thing down. We want to take some more time. So you have now 10 Republican senators, and remember, they have 52 seats, so their majority is very thin. If they want to, even if they're using these special process they can use to, you know, move bills through very quickly and they don't have to worry about the filibuster, they do need 50 votes. They lose more than two Republicans, they can't do it.
Mitch McConnell, of course, has said that they're going to move fast, and there's an enormous amount of pressure coming from conservatives who want to see the end of the Affordable Care Act. Today, the House leadership had a news conference. Paul Ryan, the speaker, said, we're going to do this in a hurry. And one of the other Republicans also said, however, nobody's going to be deprived of their insurance. Are they setting themselves a task that some of these senators, at least, think they can't achieve?
I think so. I mean, what is happening now, a big picture version of what's happening right now, we've talked about this, you've talked about this. They've been promising to repeal the law and beating up on it for 7 years now. And, you know, they're like, they keep saying, we want to get rid of this terrible law that's doing all these terrible things, and we're going to give you something better. Well, now they finally have a chance to do it, right? They have the White House. They have control of both houses of Congress. And people are saying, okay, you're going to do this. Well, what happens instead? And they don't have an answer. They cannot agree among themselves what a new system should look like. But even if you look at the ideas that are out there, it's very clear very quickly that because of their priorities, the end result ends up being a system where you have fewer people with health insurance and bigger exposure to medical bills for people who are sick. And in some combination, it really depends on the details. But, you know, people, you know, the complaints that people have about Obamacare, and there's a lot of real complaints. A lot of people, you know, don't feel like they're better off. There are definitely people who can't afford the coverage. You know, what do they want? They want lower deductibles. They want, you know, more people covered. They want more guarantees. Well, that's, you know, by and large, not what they're going to get from these Republican plans. So there's a big contradiction, and they are running smack into it finally. And when you hear Paul Ryan saying we need to do this right away, when you hear Mitch McConnell saying we need to do this right away, what they are saying, you know, in effect, I think what they realize is that if people, if this thing slows down at all, and if people really get a chance to stop and say, hey, wait a minute, we may not all love Obamacare, but what are you giving us instead? Gee, that doesn't sound better. They know that's a bad situation for them. So they're trying to move quickly, basically. They want to get past it. They want to get this vote done. They want to get it repealed quickly so they don't have to deal with that. Of course, what happens afterwards, you know, is there, you know, both in the short and long term, well, you know, that's a big question.
Here's an interesting statistic coming from the Kaiser Foundation. They show that 11.5 million of those who got insurance on exchanges, most of them live in districts that elected Republicans to the House last year.
Yeah, it mirrors the breakdown of the House pretty closely. It's about 55% of the total. And this is important, I think, in part because if you listen to Republicans, again, you know, up to and you know, through the election and shortly afterwards, you would hear them say things like, we're not worried about repealing this law. Nobody likes this law. We, you know, as if, you know, this was, you know, there was some, I think maybe they were dimly aware of the fact that there were millions of people on you know, who were getting coverage through Obamacare. But I think maybe they told themselves that, gee, they're not our constituents. We're not going to worry about these people. Quite obviously, you know, a lot of these people live in Republican districts. And if you've read stories, there have been some wonderful articles in the press. There was one in the Atlantic Monthly. There was one in Vox. You know, going on actually interviewing Trump voters and saying, you know, what do you think about Obamacare? And there's a lot of unsatisfaction. There's clearly a lot of people who don't like Obamacare. In a lot of cases, it's because they have coverage they don't like. You know, they feel it's too expensive, the out-of-pocket costs are high, very understandably. So you say, all right, so this thing's going to get taken away? They're like, oh, no. I hope he wouldn't take it away. I don't want Republicans to take it away. I want them to make it better.
Okay, but just today, Trump himself said that Congress ought to repeal it immediately and replace it simultaneously or very quickly. There are a lot of people who, of course, are also concerned about the prior conditions that was part of Obamacare and also allowing kids to stay on their parents' policies until they're 26.
Yeah, you know, Trump came out today and definitely endorsed the move quickly side of the debate. He's going to give a press conference on Wednesday, and do you know whether he will?
He says he is. We don't know if he has.
That's right. Well, yeah, we don't know whether
he can't predict.
You can't predict whether he'll actually have the press conference, whether what he says at the press conference will be consistent with what he said today, whether what he says today or tomorrow or whenever he talks about this actually makes sense. I mean, this is Trump we're talking about. But look, I mean, you want to talk about contradictions? There, you know, he's the prime example. He is, you know, I'm going to repeal Obamacare, and you know, I'm going to get rid of it, and I'm going to, and you know, and then the next breath he says, but you know, it's going to be a great system for lower cost and everyone's going to be covered.
Well, so contradiction within his own statements then, and is there also then a contradiction between the House and the Senate?
Yes. I mean, there appears to be. You know, the House seems to be more intent on moving quickly. You know, the Senate, again, because it's got the very narrow margin, because you have senators who are not all in safe districts and have, you know, you have many more who have to sort of look over their shoulder and worry about a backlash from their constituents who, and in general, the Senate tends to be the more moderate. It works both ways, right? You know, liberal or conservative. It tends to be where you find more moderates. The Senate wants to go slower, and they, you know, already you see senators speaking up and saying we want to go slow on this. So,
and a lot of people signed up more than expected, I think, for Obamacare during the last open enrollment period.
Yeah, that information just came out today. Sign-ups are actually running slightly ahead of last year's pace. And, you know, that's really important because if you listen to Paul Ryan or you listen to Donald Trump or McConnell, they all say, well, one of the reasons...
They all say it's not going to be there.
Yeah, they say it's falling apart. We need to act quickly. Well, it's not falling apart. I mean, it's got problems. We've known that for a while, but they can be fixed. It is not clearly not falling apart. The numbers state that quite clearly.
Okay.
And they are using that as a pretext for acting quickly, and that is not... You know, factually speaking, that's wrong.
All right. Jonathan Cohen again, senior national correspondent at the Huffington Post, covers health care and other policy issues as well. It's always good to have you on our program, and thanks very much for doing it today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.